Guardian Unlimited.
Hello, this is News Desk with me, John Dennis, on Monday, November the 5th. Today, police in Pakistan clash with lawyers protesting against the state of emergency imposed by General Musharraf.
Inaction at this moment is suicide for Pakistan, and I cannot allow this country to commit suicide.
Also today, the US State Department won't rule out using the interrogation technique known as waterboarding, even though it's been condemned as torture by human rights campaigners. And the fight against climate change. What are the world's biggest companies and cities doing about it? Protests across Pakistan today against the state of emergency imposed by the country's military leader Pervez Musharraf have ended in violent clashes. The president faces a diplomatic showdown with the West. Only last Friday, General Musharraf personally assured the US Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice and Britain's Prime Minister Gordon Brown that there'd be elections in January and that he'd quit as head of the army. The next day, this.
Pakistan is on the verge of destabilisation. If not arrested in time, now, without losing any further time or delaying the issue. I personally, with all my conviction and with all the facts available to me, consider that inaction at this moment is suicide for Pakistan, and I cannot allow this country to commit suicide.
Declan Walsh is The Guardian's correspondent in Islamabad, and he's on the line now. Declan, tell us about these protests today.
Well, there's been protests pretty much across the country this morning, John, in all the major cities, particularly in Lahore, where 2,000 lawyers took to the streets outside the High Court. Police with tear gas and batons charged the lawyers, arrested about 250 of them, we're told. There were also clashes in Karachi, in Peshawar, and a smaller number close to Islamabad here in Rawalpindi.
What other measures has President Musharraf imposed?
Fairly sweeping measures. He has very strong power at the moment. The press is under very tight censorship. Television channels have all been closed off, including the international news channels such as BBC and CNN. There's been an order about the written press saying that newspapers cannot publish anything that seemed to ridicule the president or the army or the government. I've just been speaking with the editor of a newspaper in Karachi who said that officials from the government and police officers have just turned up at a printing press trying to stop publication of a paper that's going out in that city this evening carrying details of these clashes between the lawyers and the police across the country. So there's very serious press censorship. Fundamental rights have been suspended. The right of political parties or opposition activists to gather in the streets is being opposed. And there's a very heavy security presence across the country, particularly here in Islamabad, where we've seen hundreds, possibly several thousand police, paramilitary rangers and barbed wire checkposts around most of the major government buildings.
Is the former Prime Minister Benazir Bhutto playing any sort of leadership role in these protests against the state of emergency?
Well, Benazir Bhutto has been rather guarded so far. She's come out and condemned the declaration of emergency. She's been calling it mini-martial rule. And she's due here in Islamabad later this afternoon or tomorrow, where she's expected to meet with other political leaders and also with the National Security Advisor, Tariq Aziz. But you'll remember that before this emergency happened, Ms. Bhutto had struck a deal of sorts with President Musharraf in return for being allowed to return from exile on October 18th. She entered talks with him really towards a possible power-sharing arrangement at general elections that were due to take place in mid-January. Now the timing of those elections is in great doubt, and it's unclear what the status of the arrangement between General Musharraf and Ms. Bhutto is, but really all eyes are on what her next move will be.
3 days ago, President Musharraf told Britain and the US that he'd hold elections in 2 months' time and stand down as army chief. Will he keep his word?
That's a question that Western diplomats here are very keen to have answered. And we understand that in the days before President Musharraf imposed this emergency rule, he spoke with foreign leaders, including including Gordon Brown. And when he spoke to them, he assured them that the emergency would not last long, and that he would return to a democratic path within a number of weeks, and that the elections would take place on time. Now, yesterday, since the last 2 days, all of those things are really up in the air. The Prime Minister Shokhrat Aziz said that the elections could be delayed by up to 1 year. Earlier this afternoon, we've had the Information Minister saying that President Musharraf's promise to take off his army uniform, in other words, to resign as army chief, is now in limbo. And I've spoken with some diplomats who said that they're very keen to find out how long President Musharraf intends to keep this emergency rule in place.
Declan Walsh in Islamabad, many thanks. Also on Guardian Unlimited today, shares in the supermarket chain J. Sainsbury are tumbling after the Qatari-based investment fund Delta 2 abandoned its £10.6 billion bid. Read about that at guardian.co.uk/business. At guardian.co.uk/UK, the latest on the search for three firefighters who, it's feared, were killed in a huge warehouse blaze in Atherstone-on-Stour in Warwickshire. They'd entered the building to look for immigrant workers it was believed could have been trapped inside. And Jermaine Greer asks, why has the world gone pink mad? It's the colour of hypocrisy, gingivitis and all things girly. The sinister tide of pink must be turned back, she says. It's the colour of hypocrisy. And that's at guardian.co.uk/art. The interrogation technique known as waterboarding is condemned by human rights groups as a form of torture. But the top legal advisor at the US State Department won't rule out the use of waterboarding, even if it were applied on American citizens by foreign intelligence services. John Bellinger, who counsels the US Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice on international law, took part in a debate hosted by Guardian America. Here he faces a question from Philippe Sands QC, who's the Professor of International Law at University College London.
Let's take the subject of interrogation techniques. I have no doubt that waterboarding is plainly prohibited by international law in relation to any person at any time in any place. Why is it that the administration has not been able to articulate that view, and why is it that even the latest nominee for Attorney General this week was unable to articulate the view that waterboarding was prohibited by international law? That's the kind of reluctance that people elsewhere focus in on, and which gives rise to concerns about the engagement with the international rule.
Well, the administration all along has felt that with respect to publicly talking about specific techniques used by an intelligence agency, or that alleged to be used or could be used or might be used, that one simply does not talk about intelligence activities. And there are many things that our CIA has been accused of doing that they are just simply not true. You know, if you read the newspapers, you would think that they had, you know, this idea of a spider's web of renditions and secret sites all across Europe. You'd think they were operating secret prisons and rendering people off the streets in every European capital. And, you know, a lot of this stuff is just not true, but we've been decided that we cannot talk specifically about any intelligence techniques. Now, with respect to any technique, even in the abstract, it actually is more difficult to apply the law to the facts. The Convention Against Torture says that torture is the intentional infliction of severe physical pain or suffering.
Or
mental pain or suffering. And so then you have to analyze whether something is, in fact, the infliction of intentional physical or mental pain or suffering. Critics tend to say, well, you shouldn't even have to ask. If you have to ask, then you're already in the quicksand, in deep waters.
Are there any circumstances in which you could imagine the use of waterboarding to be consistent with international law?
Again, we've decided that, you know, we just don't want to get engaged in hypotheticals and applying the law to the facts.
Let me put it in yet another way. Could you imagine any circumstances in which the use of waterboarding on an American national by a foreign intelligence service?
One would have to apply the facts to the law, the law to the facts, to determine whether any technique, whatever it happened to be, was causing severe physical pain or suffering.
So you're willing to exclude any American going to the International Criminal Court under any circumstances, but you're not able to exclude the possibility of waterboarding being used on the United States national by a foreign intelligence service. I mean, that just strikes me as very curious.
Well, I'm not willing to include it or exclude it. I mean, these are issues that our Justice Department, as a matter of interpreting the both domestic law on torture and international law, has concluded that just don't want to get into abstract discussions of applying the law to any set of facts. And I can certainly tell you, as a State Department official, that it makes it very difficult to explain to the world and to provide the important assurance of what we're doing or not doing if we can't talk about intelligence activities, or we can't even talk about hypotheticals.
A year ago, Sir Nicholas Stern warned in his report to the Treasury that there's still time to avoid the worst impacts of climate change if we take strong action now. Well, today, in the Green List, The Guardian publishes details of how the UK's leading 100 firms are faring in their efforts to reduce their carbon footprints. I asked Murray Armstrong what the report tells us.
It looks as if there are a number of businesses on the FTSE 100 who have actually taken this to heart. There are 68 of those businesses have gone about collecting their emissions figures and publishing them. Unfortunately, there are 11 who just haven't responded at all, and there are several others in the middle who have given some information but nothing complete. But I think it shows that some people are trying, but some people just don't get it yet.
How do firms go about calculating their carbon footprint?
Well, there's a whole host of specialists and consultancies and accountants that do these things these days. They have to measure the direct emissions that come out of their own buildings. They have to quite simply then add up the cost of the electricity or the steam or the gas that they buy, and that gives us the basis of the emissions for those companies. What you'll find in our table, though, is that we still don't have, and the Carbon Disclosure Project, which gave us the numbers for the FTSE 100, we still don't have a reasonable idea of what happens right down the supply chain. This is the next big problem.
Forum for the Future advises The Guardian on sustainability, and Sally Yu Ren is the director of its business programme. Six of the biggest companies in the world are oil firms, and Sally says weaning ourselves off oil towards a low carbon world is a big challenge.
This is where investment in sustainable technologies is really important. What we need to see is those oil and gas majors investing in new, cleaner, greener forms of energy to enable us to move to a lower carbon world.
And some of the oil companies are better than others, we should say.
Indeed, yes. If you look at the oil and gas majors, some of them don't even have carbon reduction targets. So it's really hard to understand how they are going to move to low carbon emissions without those targets. Others do have some reasonable targets, which is their aspiration in terms of how they want to cut their carbon. Others actually disclose the amount of investment they're making in alternative energy, such as BP.
The other big polluting industry is car manufacturing.
Big is probably a relative term. By far the biggest are the oil and gas majors. The car manufacturers, yes, do emit a reasonable amount of carbon dioxide, but of a different order of magnitude from the oil and gas majors.
And how much of the world's carbon are these oil companies producing? Give us some idea of the proportion.
Well, in terms of the top 10 companies per volume of sales in the world, they altogether emit around the same amount of carbon dioxide as the entire UK. The oil and gas majors are responsible for around 90% of that, so roughly about 90% of the entire emissions of the whole of the UK.
Can we leave it to the market to ensure that the big polluters mend their ways?
We can leave it to the market to a certain extent. So if the market gets better at punishing those companies that are emitting lots of carbon, rewarding those companies that are investing in a sustainable future, then that, of course, will trigger a rise in the price of carbon. It will help organisations treat carbon probably with a lot more value. But we really do need government to step into the frame here to set the right frameworks for those markets. We don't necessarily need really blunt legislation. We need government to say this is how the market should function and set the rules of the game.
And what about Walmart? What's Walmart doing to curb its emissions?
Walmart is the biggest company on the planet. It sells more products to more people than any other organisation in the entire world. It's working really actively with its supply chain to do two things: to reduce the carbon emissions which are involved in bringing goods to market, but also to reduce the carbon intensity, so the carbon within everyday products that we buy off the supermarket shelves.
Sally Uren from Forum for the Future. Well, much of the world's pollution is, of course, generated by big cities. Mark Watts is the climate change advisor to the Mayor of London, Ken Livingstone. He says the congestion charge has had a big impact on reducing carbon emissions in central London.
Well, very. It's cut emissions by 16% each year, and that's stayed now that the zone has been doubled in size. And of course, that wasn't the reason it was set up. It was set up to tackle congestion, but it's had a very good sort of side benefit.
And what other measures is London taking to cut carbon dioxide levels?
Well, we've got a plan for a 60% reduction by 2025, a totally comprehensive plan looking at every aspect of London life, which includes helping individual Londoners change their behaviour, insulate their houses better, travel slightly differently in order to reduce their emissions, works with businesses to improve the quality of their buildings and their operations to cut their emissions, looks at changing the way London's energy is supplied so more of it is decentralised, which is much more efficient than taking electricity off the grid, and then finally looks at transport and how we can continue the modal shift that's happened in London, moving people out of cars into less carbon intensive public transport, cycling and walking.
You mentioned individual homes. How are ordinary people being encouraged to play their role in reducing carbon levels?
Well, our message to London is you don't have to reduce your quality of life to tackle climate change, but you do have to change the way you live, which means cutting out the wasteful use of energy. There's no point having lights on in rooms that you're not in, leaving devices plugged in when you're not using them. Really simple things that can save you money. Our estimate is the average London household can save £300 a year if they carry out the fairly simple things that we're asking everybody to do. But then some things require a little bit of investment, like making sure you've got proper loft insulation, which we're providing subsidies to help people.
How much difference will that actually make, though? We've just been hearing from Forum from the Future's Sally Uren about how big companies, what a big impact they're making on the environment. So what difference really does it make if we turn off the light or whatever?
Well, 40% of emissions in London come from energy use in the home, which is individual Londoners' use of energy. And that can be cut by about 60%. About half of it through behavioural change and better insulation of the home, and the other half requires the government to do things which change in the way that its energy is supplied. But the short answer is individual and Londoners can make a huge difference to cutting London's carbon emissions.
What other cities does London's government look to for inspiration when it comes to reducing emissions?
Well, we set up an organisation called the C40, which brings together the 40 biggest cities in the world with a willingness to accelerate their emissions reductions, along with some of the smaller cities like Stockholm and Copenhagen that have been real exemplars. And it's those sort of cities. It's Stockholm, Copenhagen, but then the bigger ones, New York, Toronto, which have now really got some quite aggressive carbon reduction agendas and where we can really learn from each other so that we all go at the pace of the fastest rather than the slowest.
That's Mark Watts from the Mayor of London's office. And you can read the full report at guardian.co.uk/greenlist. Well, now Haroon Sadiq's here with a look at today's papers. Haroon, the Tory parliamentary candidate Nigel Hastilow has quit after refusing to apologise for claiming that Enoch Powell was right.
Yes, this is a story that's got a lot of coverage today. And what the Express is contrasting is his resignation letter in the first place, which is apologising for any embarrassment caused to the Tories. And yet at the same time, he was very defiant yesterday, claiming that he was right all along and he's had lots of support. And the Mirror, on the other hand, criticises David Cameron for not sacking him before he resigned and says, same old Tories, same old nasty stories.
And a lot of coverage of another resignation in the papers today, the boss of the world's biggest bank.
Yes, this is all related to the problems in the subprime mortgage sector. And this is Chuck Prince, the head of Citigroup. And he's followed in the footsteps of Merrill Lynch's boss, Dan O'Neill, who resigned last week. Citigroup apparently have $11 billion worth of exposure in this sector. And the FT warns that the exposures revealed so far just a fraction of what's in the market as a whole, and it warns that there are more bodies to be dug up rather ominously.
Now, the Queen's speech tomorrow, of course, we might hear something about prison overcrowding from Gordon Brown. We announced the government's next programme. But criminals could get lower sentences because of overcrowding.
That's right, John. This is a front page story on The Times, and a judge appropriately named Sir Eagle Judge, who's one of the most senior members of the judiciary. And he's saying that they should be given lesser sentences if when they're sent to prison, they're going to end up sharing a cell designed for only one person, or they're going to be denied exercise facilities.
Now, those that care about this sort of thing have enjoyed that rarest of things, a great British sporting weekend.
You're right, it is very rare, John. On the one hand, we've had Joe Calzaghe put in a brilliant performance to win the undisputed super middleweight title, the Welsh boxer. And then we've had Paula Radcliffe win the New York Marathon in a thrilling finish just 9 months after she had a baby. And this has prompted some terrible puns in the newspapers. The Guardian talks about Radcliffe being reborn. The Mirror says, "Mumbelievable." And the Mail says, "The mother of all races." But besides the puns, that these two really deserve a lot of credit. It's nice to see Brits winning rather than being praised for their courage and losing for a change.
Now, not a man celebrated for his athletic prowess, Ozzy Osbourne. Why is he angry with the police?
Well, this is North Dakota police came up with this very clever ruse to catch petty criminals, where they invited them to a party, saying that the former Black Sabbath singer would be attending. Of course, when they got there, he wasn't attending and they were all arrested. But the police didn't actually tell Mr. Osbourne, and he's not very happy about it. He said it's insulting to him and his fans. I mean, who would have thought that the man who once bit a head off a bat would be so sensitive?
Thanks very much for that, Haroon. And don't forget to read a review of the papers every day by signing up to The Wrap, our daily email service. That's at guardian.co.uk/wrap. Coming up, a bitter row at the farmers' market in Bath. But first, almost 7 decades after the Spanish Civil War, the bodies of thousands of victims of right-wing dictator General Franco still lie missing or unidentified in mass graves across Spain. But now they may be exhumed after Spain's parliament passed something called the Law on Historic Memory. This will also strip Spain of some of the remaining statues and the symbols of the Franco era. The Observer's Peter Beaumont reports.
It's All Souls Day in Madrid, the holiday when Spanish families traditionally visit the graves of the dead, a day of remembrance. But this year, the issue of memory is more potent than ever, following the passage last week of a controversial new law of historic memory by Spain's socialist government. But while some have welcomed the Law of Historic Memory's explicit recognition of the Republic's dead as long overdue, others are concerned that it is in danger of reopening the wounds of almost 70 years ago. Among the supporters of the law is Emilio Silva, a journalist and head of the Association for the Recovery of Historic Memory, whose own grandfather was one of Franco's victims, and whose grave was only finally identified in 2000.
I think this law is very important because during 32 years after the dictatorship of Franco in Spain, the politicians and the parliament don't talk about the victims of the civil war and the Franco's dictatorship. And thousands of people have suffered repression, 400,000 exiled, 500,000 imprisoned by their ideas, and thousands of killed people in ditches, in mass graves. We don't know still today the number, but there are 40,000 people in mass graves, and I think in a democratic country, with a mature democracy, it's important to take the responsibility to repair the problems with the dictatorship.
But the whole issue of getting information about the people in the mass graves, for which there's obviously been a great desire, it's been a stop-start process, hasn't it?
After the dictatorship in Spain in 1979, we have the first municipal elections for the town halls. And then when the clandestine political parties during the dictatorship arrived to the power, the people or the relatives of the Republicans say, okay, it's the moment to look for our parents, our relatives, in the mass graves. And they start to open these mass graves. But in the 1981, in the Spanish Parliament, a group of Guardia Civiles, people
this
from
the...
This
was the armed group who of police who took over the Parliament.
Yes, 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 yes. They made a coup d'etat, and this was like an order, and they have to stop to remove or to move the earth, because perhaps this... recovering the memory of the past could wake up the dictatorship again.
Emilio Silva believes the law is long overdue in recognising the Republican dead from the war. Others are concerned that far from furthering reconciliation, it risks inflaming old enmities between the right and left. And it is not simply whether the new law is the best way of recognising the rights of Franco's victims that has become an issue. There are others who believe that the dead in Spain's mass graves should be left to rest in peace. Among them is Laura Garcia Lorca, niece of one of the most famous victims of the war, the poet and playwright Federico Garcia Lorca, who was murdered by supporters of Franco in August 1936 and is buried with other victims near the village of Viznar. While the families of some of those victims would like to recover the bodies, the Lorca family would rather that the grave is left undisturbed.
We don't know if 900 or 1,000 or over 1,000 dead in that area. They would go in with shovels or whatever it is they use without knowing exactly where those four dead are. What happens to those who aren't identified? They're thrown back again into a mass grave? Mm-hmm. What happens?
I mean, it's an interesting question because, I mean, I'm not quite sure what the advantage of it would be.
I would like to make very clear, because I think these exhuming, not exhuming, is being often used in a very biased way, or demagogico, I don't know how...
Demagogic, yeah, to make a political point.
Yes, in saying that exhuming is the progressive position and not doing it is conservative.
Is Spain just now coming to terms with its history? I mean, it's been 70 years now. I mean, why now, I guess, is the reason, is the question.
Well, I think it's very important, but 70 years is not that long. 70 years is... it's many people's fathers and grandparents, and it's very close.
Peter Beaumont reporting. There are an estimated 550 farmers' markets in Britain. One of the first was in Bath in southwest England. Now the landlord wants to double its size, partly to fend off competition from the big supermarkets. But the traders and the shoppers fear that might destroy the market's raison d'etre of supplying locally produced food for local people. The Guardian's Stephen Morris reports.
Bath Farmers Market on a sunny Saturday morning. The house band, the aptly named Mighty Peas, is belting out tunes as enthusiastic creators of fine local produce sell their wares to queues of loyal customers. The whole place is bustling.
This is Phil Collins, farms in Bromham, about 70 acres. In fact, he's often knocked, you'll find he's saying to them, oh, I picked these spuds this morning at 4 o'clock. Chris Rich, founder member of the Bath Farmers Market, father and I think grandfather, whole family of market gardeners in Bath Easton.
But after they've stocked up on their fruit and veg, their cheese, their chutneys, their fish, shoppers are signing a Save Our Market petition. Bath Farmers Market was the first of the new wave of such markets when it was opened 10 years ago. But the management company that runs the market has been served notice. The landlord, a charity called Involve, wants to expand the market, perhaps doubling it in size. Stallholders and many customers are furious. To double it, they claim producers would have to be brought in from further afield. Chris Rich, you're a local market gardener. And what are your concerns about these changes?
I'm concerned that it won't be a farmer's market as we know it. And the rules and regulations we've drawn up about distance, air miles and producers being here selling their products. If they want to increase the market, the traders just aren't out there unless they bring in people who aren't strictly farmers market traders. Well, I'm just concerned that MVolve can just muscle in and take over a market which is so vibrant in a moment. I mean, you can see for yourself. I mean, it's a thriving market. And why would anybody want to come and take it? Well, obviously, because they can see a pot of gold at the end of the rainbow, I would think. But it's certainly a worry. Since we had the first letter a week ago, giving us a month to either join them or get out virtually, because it's our business. And most people in here, it's their only business. And what else do they do?
The debate over Bath Farmers Market is being followed closely across the country. There are now around 550 farmers markets in the UK, worth an estimated £220 million a year. A third of households say they visited a farmers market in the last 12 months. By expanding, will the markets lose sight of what they're all about? Cheese producer Tim Homewood at Bath Farmers Market thinks so.
It is a good place to come and sell, but it's also an extremely sociable market. I have a lot of friends, a lot of regulars. This is cheese I've made, and I get to see the people try it. So I'm basically doing it from milking all the way through to actually selling it, and that's quite a satisfying job.
It means a tremendous amount. I've been coming since the very first day. It means I can put food in front of my family, which is unpolluted, it's fresh. I know where it comes from. If I want to, I can actually go and look at the farms. I've walked in the fields where the sheep are grazed when I'm buying the lamb. And it means food that tastes good. Every Sunday, I say, I don't think there's anybody in the country eating better than I am, with organic meat and all these vegetables that taste like they used to taste.
Councillor Paul Crossley, how important is this market to the people of Bath?
This market is really important to the people of Bath. And the problem is, they're just taking over something that has been working very successfully for 10 years. They've come out of it from nowhere. No one knows what the purpose or the reason for them is and how the new scheme is going to work. And a lot of concern.
Steve Morris reporting. Envolve, the landlords of Bath Farmers Market, weren't available to do an interview with us, but their director told us that the farmers market has huge potential to grow while still being true to the original pioneering ideals of directly connecting producers with their customers. He wouldn't say who the new stallholders might be, but he claimed that they were committed to local produce. Today's edition of News Desk was produced by Andy Duckworth, Scott Corley and Tim Mabey. I'm John Dennis. Thank you for listening.
Guardian Unlimited.